This is an interview with Jack Comerford for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project on the history of St. Paul the Apostle Parish by Jerry Hisney at the Comerford Residence, the 46 Olman Drive, New Middletown, Ohio, on December the 6th, 1984 at 3 p.m. First of all, Jack, could you tell me a little bit about your family and background, you know, where you're born? And
well, I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, 1925, June 23. I was born on the west side of Youngstown. I was a twin. I come from a family of about five children. My father died when I was about 3 years old. My mother raised the rest of us. She worked at the county courthouse under quite a few of the judges, Judge Lyons, and a few just even before Judge Lyons. I can't remember all of their names. Judge Ford is the latest. She died in 1963. We moved here to Middletown in 1957 from Boardman. But I guess I'm jumping. I met my wife in 1947, and we were married in 1948, which was a short courtship. But we're still together. Just celebrated our 36th anniversary. And we have three children, the oldest, which is Robert, Donna Jean, and Kathy. They're all, have gone to, Bob went to Mooney, and Kathy and Donna Jean graduated from Springfield. I enjoyed New Middletown now very much. In fact, we wouldn't even consider moving from New Middletown. When we first moved here, though, it was very, very rough. We was new and found it kind of hard to get adjusted. In fact, we even threatened to move the first, I don't know how many times within the first 5 years here. We even went so far as even to contact our real estate agent. But we, for some reason, I don't know what happened, we just didn't do it. We stayed, and after that first 5 years, then things started changing the other way, and we got to like it so much that we just couldn't move to it in the middle of time. We became members of St. Paul's, which was then, it was only about 3 years old, the parish out here. It was in 57. I think they started here in 54
been their first full year. Yeah. Like the first Mass was the Christmas Mass of 53.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and we were, became acquainted, as I say, after the first 5 years, became acquainted with the people. We became quite active with the church, which we were members of the Gilmar Club, which was one of the clubs that Father Hayday started. We also belonged to the bus club, which when we started sending our children to Holy Family, we had to provide our own bus transportation for the children to go to Holy Family. So we formed a club amongst all the parents of the children of the church and bought our own bus and even drove it, took turns driving it, to drive it, picking up the children, taking us home, picking them up. And we were quite successful in that until things just started changing around then. I guess after that, the laws changed where they provided transportation for the children in the middle school. I'm quite active with the parish myself as a council member, as a rector, Eucharistic minister. I sing with the choir when I have a choir. And I work with a few of the different organizations in the parish.
Yeah, I see that you're a Navy veteran. And what area did you partake in the war?
I was drafted in 1943, and I went into the Navy. I was fortunate enough to get into the Navy. And, I served 6 weeks in boot camp, Green Bay. After we got mustered out of boot camp, we were sent right straight to Brooklyn Navy Yards in New York and put directly on a destroyer. I was on that same destroyer all through the war until I got discharged in 1946. I was in the European North Atlantic European theater, served in Africa, down in around the Mediterranean area for a few months. The rest of the time was in the South Pacific, out in Japan, yeah, on all the islands in the South Pacific. We ended up on Okinawa, ready to be one of the first group to head for the Japanese mainland when they dropped the atomic bomb. So that, I always say that it's a heck of a thing that they had to drop the atomic bomb to cause an end to the war, but I still feel, and a number of my other fellow, the other fellows that served with me on our ship, especially our ship, who carried the frogmen, and we felt that we probably wouldn't be here if they didn't drop that atomic bomb, because we were going to be the first ones to head to the Japanese mainland.
Did you have any idea of the bomb being dropped?
Not until after it had been dropped. This was 24 hours later we got word, because we were scheduled. We already had orders to pull out with our force, this task force that we were with, the frogmen, to... they're the ones that you take into the shore and blow up all obstacles. And we were already had our orders to move out, and it was 24 hours later that we got word that the bomb had been dropped. So there was no definite surrender yet, but we were told to hold back, because then they dropped the second bomb, and that's when it we became the end. Then we did go on in, though, with Missouri. We were in the Third Fleet, and our ship was, the destroyer was right alongside of the Missouri. Well, a matter of maybe 150 yards away when MacArthur and him signed the surrender treaty on the...
Could you see anything from that distance?
Through glasses, yes. Yes, we could see a few. We could see the Japanese officials there. Well, I think the part that sticks in my mind the most was not so much that. I remember that quite a bit. But the part that sticks in my mind the most is our destroyer was one of the first to pull right into, tie up to the Japanese docks right inside of Yokohama Bay there. And this was after the treaty was signed. No ships were tied up until after that. We just anchored in the bay. But we were one of the first to pull in and then secure, to go in and secure the docks, any soldiers and stuff like that. What sticks in my mind is the fact that I was a coxswain in the Navy, and I was in charge of some of the deck force. In fact, the crew I had was on what we call the forecastle crew, the bow of the ship. And as we pull in, you're supposed to, you throw a line to the dock. Well, naturally, an unfriendly dock where you have foreign people, there's no one there and our people to grab your line. So you normally throw what we call a monkey fist first to drag the heavier line across. Someone's supposed to grab that, pull the heavy line across, but these soldiers were all sitting on the dock with their rifles, but all just sitting down there, not doing nothing. And it was funny to see that monkey fist fly over and roll down that dock and come clean off of the pier and go into the water, and you have to fish it out, throw it again, because no one was grabbing it. And our captain was trying to keep the ship from running into the dock, so you have to back off again and come in again. I think that happened about two times. Our chief boat's mate, which was a very, very, I have to say, a gruff person, but a very likable person, he got on a bullhorn, and he's standing there with a rifle in his hand, and he said, in English, naturally, but I imagine someone must have understood it, because he said, if they don't grab that fist this time, he says, I'm going to start shooting. And when I threw it the next time, someone did grab it, and they pulled the line in. But that's the thing that sticks in my mind the most about the Japanese, the end of the war for Japan.
Mm-hmm. Were you in Japan long then?
I think we stayed in Yokohama Bay there probably about a month, not quite a month, maybe 3 weeks or so. We did have liberty, but not too much, because was strange being in a place like that.
You know, my father-in-law was in the military police, right, in 1946. He was station in Japan, he tells me about, you know, however, he's 6'5", and so he said he, you know, he just dwarfed.
Oh, yeah, yes, right.
Dwarfed most of the Japanese.
It was funny seeing so many, I mean, it's one thing when you run across a short person, you happen, but when you run across everyone that's shorter than you, it seems strange to be in a crowd of people like that. And they are very small people.
Getting to when you worked in the mill, okay, what did you do as a, you know, in the steel industry?
I was a crane operator. First I had worked with Republic Steel. I started with them in 1946, after I come out of the service. And I worked there, which work wasn't too good then. In fact, I was lucky if I worked maybe 6 months out of the year, laid off. And that's when I met my wife, Mary. And after I got married, being that I was married and had more responsibility now, I had to try and find other income. So I also worked part-time with Sahio and worked with them off and on when I wasn't working in the mill. So finally, I got tired of being laid off so much at Republic, and I quit working at Republic and went full-time with Sahio. And I worked with them for a number of years, ended up with a station of my own with Humble Oil until business got bad. Couldn't take that anymore, so I finally went back in the mill with Sheet and Tube in 1963. And I worked there till 1980 till they shut it down. I was with Sheet and Tube, I was a charge machine operator in the open. And I was very active with the local union. I was a recording secretary for our local for 6 years. I was a shop chairman for a number of years and previous representative.
Did Black Monday catch you by surprise?
Black Monday caught most of the people in Camel by surprise. We were surprised in a way, but Black Monday didn't affect us right then, because we were fortunate, we were still working at Briar Hill. So as far as being discouraged and disgusted with losing our job, yeah, we were just as bad off as those in Camel, but ours was more or less, we knew ours was coming. We knew it was, because you could see the handwriting on the wall. But a lot of people just didn't want to believe it. And when it did happen, hit us in 1979, they shut us down. I worked on until January of 80. But Black Monday really surprised a lot of people. You know, it was something that was just couldn't perceive that would ever happen.
You know, that's one of the things they want to do at the university is go out now, start talking to steel workers, because it's been 4 or 5 years now, and I think if they would have gone out right away, it would have been a lot of anger and vehement against talking, but I think now you may be able to get some stuff in them. Can you get into the history of St. Paul's and your involvement? When you moved into the community in the 1950s, what was Springfield Township or New Middletown like at that time?
Well, as I said before, to us maybe it was the fact that we were strangers, we were new, we didn't feel as though as we really didn't feel welcome. And maybe a lot of that was our own fault too, I don't know. It might have been. It probably was that, because it seems as though later on we found out that a lot of people weren't as unfriendly as we thought maybe they were. But
there was no welcome wagon committee back then?
No.
In the community?
We didn't have the stores that they have here now. I mean, the plaza wasn't here, and this was all open field. The Bounds lived up here on the corner then, the old house that was they burnt down, which I thought was a shame. That was really a historical site that used to sit on the corner up here then. In fact, I was told that it used to be a stagecoach stop back in the early days.
And, 170 is mm-hmm. New Middletown. It's called New Middletown because it's halfway between Pittsburgh and Cleveland on the stagecoach route at that time.
And it's changed quite a bit as far as number of people. It's increased quite a bit. New Middletown,
what did the majority of the people, if you had to categorize their occupations out here at that time, what did most of the people out here do for a living?
I would say you could categorize that in probably three categories. They were either farmers, steel workers, or construction workers in New Middletown. That's the way I feel. Now, maybe I'm not, but I feel that the majority of the people I knew personally here, that was their occupation.
And that's what I'm getting from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that very, very few professional.
Very, very few, yes. Other than maybe a doctor or dentist here or there, which was our doctor, became Dr. Finley. His office was right across the way over here first, mm-hmm. over where the Tiger Table is right now. He was in that area. Then he moved up the road. Now he's at Paul.
What were the people of St. Paul's like then?
I really think that was one of the reasons why we probably finally decided to stay here, was after becoming acquainted with the people of St. Paul's Parish and getting acquainted with them, finding out that they're very likable and friendly people, and they seemed as though they were the kind of people that we want to associate with and be with, and I really think that's one of the reasons why we finally changed our mind and didn't turn around and sell our house and move out of here.
Okay. Did Father Paulowitz, who's pastor then, do anything special to greet new members to the parish that you can recall?
Not that I can recall, other than if you just went down to the parish and signed up as a new member. I don't know of any pastor that we had that did anything special as far as have any special program as far as greeting new members. I think most of them tried to encourage their parishioners themselves to take this on and welcome new members into the parish. Not just the pastor.
What was Father Paulowitz like then? Since you came in after the parish had started, what type of pastor did you find him to be?
I found Father Paulowitz to be very much a priest. He was very dedicated to his vocation as a priest. He didn't have as much, maybe, assistance as he would have liked to have had. Naturally, they wouldn't have had another assistant here, but, I mean, from the parishioners. But, and I think, maybe in a way, it was a little bit of his own fault because he didn't like to delegate authority to anybody. And Father Paulowitz was of the old school, just like a lot of other pastors that tried to just hold the reins themselves and not... I served on council under Father Paulowitz. He appointed me to council then, that type of church council, which was more or less
rubber stamp?
Rubber stamp, I guess, yeah, figurehead, you know, something like that. You were just appointed just to say that there was someone appointed to council. As far as authority goes, maybe this was what created a few of the arguments among some of the other parishioners and Father Paulowitz because of the fact that it was more, as you say, a rubber stamp, and they wanted to have a little more say-so how the parish should be run and what you should do. But Father Paulowitz, as far as a person goes, and a priest, and a confessor, I thought he was a very, very nice person. I liked Father Paulowitz a lot, and I gave him a lot of credit for what he did to hold the parish together, bringing it in, helping the parish get started.
When you joined in 57, about how many families would you say were?
I think there was 250 families
by then. Really?
In the parish then.
That means because there was I've heard from 50 to about 90 families.
Within that period, within 3 years.
When it got started.
Yeah.
And it grew.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, of course, that's the post-World War II boom.
Yeah. I think it's roughly around that area. The only reason I say that is because of being on council and then here seeing some of that. Well, we used to have a, he used to put out once a year a book itemizing what each family gave.
How did the community respond to that? Because that's one thing that I know, since I belong here, we haven't done that.
No.
But I know St. Matthias, where I belonged before with my wife, that's done.
Yeah.
Done a couple times a year.
Well, they didn't like it too well. I know the majority of the people did, preferred not to have that, but it seems as though, as I say, Father Polowitz came from an older school of priests, and it seems as though this was just a thing to do. I know it was done when I was a child in St. Brenda's on the west side. They used to publish what each family gave for the year. And this is a reason, I can say, this is how I know. I roughly figured there was about 200, 250 families because of that book that was put out every year. Which kind of, I guess, kind of embarrassing to people to have that published. I'm glad it isn't being done now, so I wouldn't care whether you gave $5,000 a year or $2 a year. I still don't think it should be published.
Since you were, you've been on the council at different times. When you were on the council there in the 50s with Father Polowitz, what were the meetings like?
Well, they were more or less pre-planned. There wasn't too much discussion other than Father Polowitz would tell you what he was going to do and what he had done, not should we or will we. It was either it was done or it wasn't done. You know, that's all it was.
How often did you meet?
I think we only met about 3 or 4 times a year back then. We didn't meet monthly. Then.
Okay. Where did you hold the meetings at?
At the rectory. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, when your wife joined, what organizations did you, besides council? You mentioned choir, okay, choir.
Well, I belonged to the men's choir. We had an all-men's choir then, back then. In fact, Johnny Brenton was the choir director of our choir then, and Betty, our organist. But I belonged to the All Men's Choir for a number of years, for as long as it lasted. And I belonged to the bus club, which we had then. This is when we started sending the children to Holy Family.
But how many families back then were involved in that?
I would think probably somewhere between 60 and 70 or 80 some families. Would you say Mary Lynn?
The bus club.
I have some old reports in there from the bus club I'd have to look at. I mean, I could get them out.
I know I went to Holy Family, mm-hmm. So I know that I lived in Poland. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I served
the ages, did you?
Pardon me?
Donna. You go to Holy Family?
No. Yeah, well, they started. They both did. Yeah.
She got your age.
Yeah. 34.
Yeah. She didn't finish at Holy Family, mm-hmm. But they went there at first. Yeah. So things got rougher for me in the mill. You know,
yeah.
I got laid off.
Couldn't afford to keep all three.
I couldn't afford to keep them.
She was in class. When did she graduate?
It went to 5 years at Holy Family, I think.
Donna Jean graduated in 69, I think.
Yeah, she was in. She was in. Mm-hmm. Class piano. That's asking me to go back and try to remember my classmates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I served as the president of our bus club 1 year. That's other than that, back in those days, as far as organizations that I belonged to in the church.
That you had, but you had one bus, to
just the one bus. Yes, it was a used bus we bought. We, as I said, we used to hold dances. We used to hold any kind of a money raising thing that we could have. Paul Kachik and few of the other fellows got together and they start holding these $100 dinners once a year, which you paid $100 a plate. And you went to this dinner and they gave away Cadillacs, first prizes, and so on down. We sold just 100 tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And as the name was drawn out, 100 names were drawn out, and for every five names, the first and the fifth name, every fifth name on up to, I think, 25, got like a $100 bond or something. Then the 25th name got a larger prize, and then every fifth name from there up to 50 got a $100 bond. And so on up to the 25, 50, 75. Then the 100th one got the Cadillac, and or the money was given. And we raised we held, I think, two or three of those, to raise money for the bus club. And things like that with other dances we held and stuff like that, that raised money by this used bus that we used for taking children away from. The first, well, we had two of them for me. The first one we bought was a little older. It was an old Rio, and it was really an antique. It served a purpose.
Yeah, I can remember pulling into the Holy Family lot back then. Because, you know, a lot of the kids that live out here, I could, you know, at least the ones that stayed through with me, because Lockshaw's right over there in, mm-hmm. you know, Sycamore, and yeah. Jilly Burke, Mickey's one son was in my class. Who else? Barb Kim was a year behind me. Mm-hmm. Gresko's.
Yeah.
Dolan's.
Pays, Marty Pays. No, he didn't go to
Mooney.
He went to Mooney with Bob.
I didn't go to Mooney, though. The Holy Family went to the Pole House. It was tough for him to send us on to that, too, because there were seven of us. And
yeah.
She got to my mother, because my dad died when I was young, too. Got to the point where I made it through, and my older sister made it through 8 years of parochial school. And that was it. After we got done, the other five, I think the one made it to seventh grade, and the other ones made maybe 1 or 2 years, and she just couldn't afford to.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the way we got to it first. Kind of rough.
When you came to St. Paul's, what type of impression did the church have? You know, this physical structure itself, when you went into it for the first time?
I think we were very impressed with it, myself, anyhow. I really was impressed. To me, it looked like a church. It had that sort of old-style appeal of the church.
Were the murals still up
there? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, the murals are up above the altar in the sanctuary.
Okay, and what, give me your impression of the murals. What are the murals about? If you could
remember,
it's all of St. Paul's life. That's what Mickey said.
Right. And I remember the most thing that sticks in my mind is the dove of the Holy Spirit. It's right in the center, showing the light coming straight down to the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
And then on each side was the, I think it was St. Paul, Apostle, and Peter. So that's what was up there at first.
Above the eye, a little over.
Yes, that was above or below the dove. I can't remember now which one it was. It was in there, yeah. Yeah, I remember the eye now, too.
People I've talked to, they said their kids were
impressed with that.
Impressed and in awe and afraid, of course, to move.
Because that I was watching.
That I was watching. And, of course, they were as quiet as could be because they knew that the Lord was there. And no matter where you were at in the church, position-wise, it was looking at you.
Yeah. I think that's carry over from the old country, that type of thing.
Well, I know from what I've found out, I mean, that's one of the things I've definitely found out, that a lot of the people who really were involved in the formation of the church were, you know, your ethnic groups.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, especially a lot of Eastern Europeans, mm-hmm. as such goes, and Hutch goes, a lot of Slovaks. And that's something that Mary Branton and someone else pointed out, that a lot of the families moved in here right around World War I, as the Pennsylvania Dutch moved westward to the farms, because a lot of these farms that were here were established by the Pennsylvania Dutch in the 1800s.
Yeah.
As they moved, because of, I guess, they felt that they were being crowded in by society, they moved westward. And a lot of the immigrants who were farmers back there had not a chance to get the farm and work in the still mill at the same time.
I guess that St. Paul's itself, I think, from what I understand, it was pretty well predominantly Slovak back in the very formation of St. Paul.
If you look at that book, that's the one picture, but the one here, you go through the original membership here and you look at the names, it's...
Mm-hmm.
There's a dominance of Belascos, Blaskies, Baskies, Brashaks, Bonovich, Borziks, Cedars, Chizekas, Dubeks, Billiks, Boers, Hutchkos, Michael Sy was a member here back at that time. Usually nearest, but he died in 59, 60, right? Do you know?
Who did?
Cyril. Sy, his name?
Oh! Yeah. Because
I know I was looking at this list, you have a lot of Polish or Slovaks, monkeys.
Yeah. I know, that was another thing, too. As I said, we used to have the all-men's choir, and Christmas Eve at midnight mass, we'd be there probably half hour, 45 minutes before mass, and we'd be singing Christmas hymns. And we used to sing some of the Christmas hymns in Slovak. I can't speak Slovak or nothing like that, but I'd go along with the fellas and I would pick up the words as I went along. We used to sing the Slovak hymns.
No. That's something I haven't, because I talked with John Markatan, and with John, he didn't mention anything like that. That's something I wanted to ask, and I forgot.
Yeah, they used to, for the fact that there were so many of the Slovak-speaking people in our parish then, and a lot of them, I understand, I guess, didn't really speak that much English yet. We used to sing or with the fact that they were just more or less a nostalgic thing that they wanted to do for them because of nationality. So we used to sing quite a hymns in English and Slovak every Christmas Eve.
On the murals, do you recall when the murals were painted over? About when did that take place? And
I think with Father Haydake.
And why? Do you know why?
I don't really know why. No, I don't know why. I do know it.
Change?
All I know is the fact that they said the church needed painted. And my only assumption was the reason the murals were painted over was the fact that they could not have them repainted again for cost or something. And to paint around them, they probably wouldn't have looked as well. But I do know it was done during Father Haydake's.
That's also Vatican II time, right?
That was done before Vatican II.
Okay.
I do. I really think it was before Vatican II, because Vatican II didn't come in until the early the 60s. And that is, started. It didn't really come into practice until
mid to later 60s.
Yeah. But I think that was done before that, because the church did need painted, and I think they were, as far as cost factor, they just wanted to save money. So they just painted it.
How did the parish respond to it when it took place?
I myself don't remember hearing too much about that. I don't know. There might have been, as I say, amongst those original parishioners.
Yeah. People I've really talked to, they can't tell me why, and they... Just a few of them said that they really were upset. A lot of the parents said they were relieved when the eye was painted over, that their kids were relieved. And that didn't bother them.
No, it really didn't.
I know Mickey said that the murals were beautiful.
They were beautiful murals. That, they weren't sloppy. They were very good, yeah. But as I said, it's something that, you know, that if they're not taken care of, they have to be touched up or something. I don't, I personally think that's why I thought it was a cost. Well, they were getting faded out.
Yes.
And to have to keep them, they would have had to have been repainted.
That probably would have been definitely expensive.
You couldn't get the same artist who ever put them up there originally, so I think he felt that.
Oh, do we have a picture of it?
Yeah, there we go.
This is the first one I've come across. Okay.
I have a spare one if you want to keep that. These are the Olin boys. You know, it's altar boys. Those two boys are Olin boys.
Because that's, I wanted to talk, that's something in the project I want to talk to a couple altar boys along the way. You know, it's, those are names I've been given.
Me and George.
Okay. That's the mural, huh? There he is, kind of struck down off of the horse.
Yeah, it's the eye. Wasn't, no, maybe it was after that there was a dove put up here. I thought there was a dove. Unless I'm confusing it with the eye.
It definitely is a refer back to the old style.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Things written on that, too, doing it, whatever.
Kathy's name's on there.
Yeah, that's the first picture I've been able to come up with.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, well, you can keep this. You got another one.
Okay. That way, you know, Mary gave me a couple things. She was nice. This was a one of the picnics they had back in 52. You know, has the expenses and all bit and how much they cleared at the end. You know, I was impressed with, you know, for one picnic, they pulled in $1,200, almost $1,300.
Good.
Yeah. The first bingo announcement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
it. And then there's this newspaper clipping from the blessing ceremonies in 54 of the church.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's out of the Struthers newspaper, but the whole front page talks about the parish there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't really tell, and something like that, you can't really even see them.
You just barely see up above.
Yeah, and you really can't appreciate them.
Mm-hmm. No.
And of course,
I personally think as far as that painting, I mean, the mural stuff goes, I don't think they had anyone that could do that.
Oh, no,
that was capable.
Yeah,
that's,
well, that's why I say, I think.
Yeah, that had to be a definite factor.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad they couldn't have put some type of
pretty
sealer over it, though, because that would have kept it from fading.
Yeah.
Like today, you could do that, put a mural up and put a sealer over it, and you would still have it.
I noticed that I
forgot you even had them. I would like to show that to Father Brooks one time.
Well, a lot of stuff. Would be very interested. When I sit down, because I want to go in. He has all these financial records that when I continue on doing the history here,
I want to keep mine.
Because I want to get something written up.
Mm-hmm.
Additional, maybe even, you know, put it out so people can see it. I'm going to sit down with all the records that he has. With the Jomar Club, that you mentioned, what was its purpose?
The Jomar Club is really strictly a social club. It was founded under Father Hayday. He felt that to bring the people together a little more, they should have some type of a social club. He felt, I guess, kind of like that everything shouldn't be strictly church business, that there should be some socializing. And they wanted to have it as a married couples club, but they didn't want to call it a married couples club. So they were thinking of Joseph and Mary, so instead of saying Joseph or Mary, they call it Joe and Mark. Joseph for Joseph and Mary, that's where the Joe Mark came. And that's what it was, strictly social club. No dances.
He also assisted the Alder Guild, too.
Well, yes, he assisted the Alder Guild as far as finances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where were the dances held?
Right
at the church?
Basement,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We used to hold dances there. Well, I think one dance we had 100 couples. was the biggest dance we've had there.
Pretty good amount of people, though, for down there.
Right. So the rest of them usually are down around maybe 50, 60 couples, something like that. And then we used to hold other doings. We'd get together and maybe go out to dancing somewhere at some club, or maybe go out to dinner. We used to go to shows. We had roller skating parties we used to have, things like that. We used to have in the fall of the year, I guess, what they called a, what was that? We went around the houses, scavenger hunts. We used to hold those. And we didn't go right just to the church. We'd go all over the whole village.
Well, I've been involved in those. Those are fun. When did the Joe Mark Club cease to exist?
Joe Mark Club ceased to exist after Father Hayday left our parish. Father Bissler came, and it wasn't because of Father Bissler. It was because there was other people in the parish that were very much against the Joe Mark Club. There's a reason why it finally broke up. In fact, we tried to hold on to it by holding our meetings at the houses. In fact, our last president, I think, was Pete Loading of our Joe Mark Club then, and we were holding our meetings at his house. But the people of the parish, some of the people of the parish, felt that it was scandalous to have dances and drinking parties in the basement of the church. And they thought it was, we were going against what our Catholic teaching taught us as far as, and that's why we finally got.
Oh, so that's why it went down.
So, but it was, we enjoyed it very much. I see the, what they call the Booster Club, is that what they call it now? They're trying to come around this way, but they're not being very successful. And I told, as I told Father, that they ought to convey to the people that I think that they, if they would put a little more effort in trying to have some kind of social doings for the people of the parish, that they would be great success at it. It takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. It does take an awful lot of work. I know that we were involved in putting on a couple of the dances and doings. And we used to have a Halloween party down at the Gilmore Club. We sold a Halloween dance and a masquerade dance. And people come dressed up. We were very happy and very nice.
Here's a sociological question. Do you think that, you know, things like that have decreased because of how the social changes, like dances, and that, you know, because one thing I see today at St. Paul's is, you know, even though it's a parish and there's 600 some families, it's really not, you have a certain amount of people who are involved in things, and then you have a tremendous amount of people who you see them occasionally at Mass, but when you have activities, is that a reflection of how the times have been?
Well, I would say that's what it really is a reflection of what the times are going, how things change as far as society goes. I don't think it's a reflection on the church itself. I think it's people just tend to live their lives of the way society changes things. Our children come up with a different style of living, and people today, I feel, tend to be more loners as far as their families are concerned. Mm-hmm. They don't want to reach out, and that is combined with other families, be parts of other families like we used to back then. And I have to say that the times cause that, because, well, I can remember, I think Mary and me, we get this feeling of our way we were was the fact that we were born and raised during the Depression time, and that's the only way you survived then, was to live with your neighbors like they were part of your family, and you had to get along with one another. I mean, not to get along with one another, but to survive. I think each one held everybody else up. And but that isn't needed today. People are more independent today.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to find that they'd rather do the things the way they want to do them, and they don't want to be involved with other people. People just don't want to get involved. I don't think it's any reflection on the church itself.
That's a basic point I've gotten from a lot of people, that this was a very tight community, but I think you definitely have that depression carryover, because a lot of the original families that were here had been here, and they had helped each other out through thick and thin, and I think from what I've seen, and you know, how they quickly the church went up once it was given the okay, and how much money that at that time people came, you know, forward with, even though it didn't cost, I think I've seen figures from $90,000 to about $150,000 what it cost to build the church back then.
Yeah.
You know, the people definitely came out with money, and they, you know, they were involved in a lot of things. But today, because of the fact that we are at jet age or space age society, we're always on the go and don't take time out to communicate with our fellow man.
Right.
Okay, looking at Father Heyday, then, what was he like?
Father Heyday was, the word I'm looking for is strictly a business priest. I'm not saying he didn't perform his duties as a pastor of the parish or as a spiritual guide, or as Mary says. No, he was that, but he was strictly a business type of priest. He was all business. In other words, I liked Father Heyday in a way, but I found him a little colder than Father Apollowitz or the other priests. Father Heyday is one, when he came here, he removed myself and a couple other people from the council when he came. We all got the impression that he wanted strictly businessmen on council.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want just ordinary people that had no function with business or didn't know how business operated. That's the impression we got.
And about Father Bissler, who came in next?
Father Bissler was just complete opposite. He was a very, very friendly, likable person. And he got along with everybody, whether he was in business or in labor or what you were. He got along well with you. He wasn't liked by certain people of the parish, but then there's all pastors are never liked 100% by people of the parish. There's always someone who wasn't.
I know him from St. Brendan's. My wife taught there. So I had a chance to meet him. He is a very personable. Personable fellow.
In fact, Father Bissler was one really that got me started as being active in the parish as far as lectures or just stuff.
Okay, and then Father O'Neill.
Father O'Neill was to me just as the number of priests said, he's a priest. He knew his duties as a priest, and he fulfilled his spiritual guiding, and he was very, very strong on that. Very strong. He might have been a little lax as far as exact things go. As far as, well, I used to remember during midnight mass or Easter vigil mass, Father O'Neill was he would try to do everything himself. He knew how to do it, but he would. We tried to do everything himself so much that certain things would get mixed up. But he was a very, very likable person. And as I say, the same thing with him. There were a number of people who didn't like Father O'Neill.
I think he's, just from what my connection with, I think he's a person, if you got to know him on a one-to-one basis.
Very, very likable.
You know, very intelligent man.
Very intelligent, oh yes.
I mean,
yes, he was.
Just, you know, I think for a lot of people, just when I was, because he was pastor when I joined the parish. I think if you sat back there and never had a chance to meet him, he could be.
Yeah. Father O'Neill was
very firm.
To him, a spade was a spade,
right.
And he let you know it. He didn't hide nothing from you. Mm-hmm. He told you exactly the way he felt and how he felt.
Looking at the Vatican II changes, which of course, had a tremendous impact, I think, on the Catholic Church. First of all, what was your impression of the initial changes, you know, going from the Latin to the English vernacular and making the basic changes of turning the altar to face the congregation?
Well, that didn't bother me so much, the original change at first. It didn't bother me that much, really. In fact, in a way, I kind of enjoyed going to the vernacular. But I guess what really made me stop and think down the line was when they start making the whole Mass English, where they took out, see, originally they kept some parts still in Latin. And so you still had some semblance of the old style of Mass left there. As far as changing the altar around, I found that very enjoyable myself, because even when I was an altar boy, all through grade school, St. Brendan's and other things, I never did understand why our backs were facing the congregation. To me, I felt that you should be facing each other. And so as far as when they changed it around, that didn't bother me. In fact, I enjoyed it very much.
How did the people of the parish out here respond?
Well, I
had a lot of the old traditionalists.
Yes, there was a lot of them took it very, very hard. In fact, some of them took it so hard that as different priests came in as pastor, certain numbers of families would leave the church, would not attend Mass here. And not that they'd leave the area, but they would start attending Mass at other churches. What they found, I don't know, or why, I don't know. But I know that happened to quite a few people. Now, whether it was personalities of the pastor or whether it was because of Vatican II, I don't know. I do know a lot of people suffer yet today because of Vatican II, because of different changes in the function, the way Mass is being done.
Well, I've gotten some complaints that I've heard is the use of the lay ministers.
Yes. Like I say, back when Father Bissler was here, when he asked me if I would become a lector. We called it commentator then. And I told him I didn't. Whether I could or not, I'd try. In fact, myself and John Saldo, who's dead now,
he had that deep, resounding voice.
We both went on at the same time. And
you can hear it right now.
After I got onto it, I liked it very much as far as the commentary.
Yeah, we were friends with the family.
Yeah. But when the time came from Vatican II where they brought in the Eucharistic ministers, now this was, the biggest jump in Vatican II. It was as far as involving the lay goes, was into the Eucharistic ministry. And I think there was myself, Mickey Burke, Jim Hollerin and Paul Simone, John Saldo, Owens, what's his name, they came down here for really about a ton of it. He came down to the South Range and watch. Well, anyhow, we were all sent to...
One of the Olins?
Here.
Really? He's not an Olin.
Married an Olin girl.
He's blonde-headed kid.
John?
John, the name will come to me.
K. Starts with a K.
You get into it too, Bert. But anyhow, we were all...
Krebs.
John Krebs, yes. He was one of the ones. And we were all the ones had to go to Mooney for instructions on Eucharistic ministry. That is, Father Bissler asked us to. And I told him, I will go. I said, but I will not guarantee you that I'll be able to do it. I said, because I don't think I'm worthy to do that. I said, because it was something that was never even thought of. I was raised under the old school where you didn't even let the host touch your teeth,
correct?
Let alone put it in your hand. And I went to that meeting, and I can't remember which priest gave the talk at first. It wasn't Bishop Malone. It was one of the other priests who gave a talk on it. It was one of the theologians, anyway. And when he said, he gave us a story about the little boy that served Mass for, in the old country, I can't remember exactly where it was in the name, but where he used to bring the host to the prisoners. And it was against the law for him to do that, and he was sneaking in. Until one day he was almost caught, so to avoid having desecrated the host, he ate it all himself. And in other words, what he was getting to, he said that what makes people feel that their tongue is holier than their hands? Why do you feel that your tongue is much closer to God than your hands? There is no reason for it. It isn't.
Neither.
It's not cleaner. In fact, your mouth is dirtier.
In all reality, yes.
Yes. So this was really changed my mind, my view, outlook on that part of it. And since then, in studying a lot of it and participating in a lot of it, I find that I have come a long way in understanding different aspects of my faith.
You think that, you know, when the changes, you know, took place throughout in the 60s and 70s, that the church did a good job of educating the people before changes?
No, I think they could have done much better. That's probably one of the greatest reasons for a lot of the disruptions we have, or people leaving the church and stuff like that. I think that's one of the greatest reasons for it, because of the lack of a better way of educating. I think that if that was just one little item as far as myself goes, as far as the host goes on this interesting minute, but I think if things like this were expressed to the people all along in different ways, that is, to help them understand, you know, get a picture in your mind of why, I think it would have been a lot easier on a lot of people. So, it's just like today we're having a lot of problems with people understanding different things. And the reason is people tend to still use the old style of attending Mass, that they're just at Mass for themselves, that this is their own private little Mass in their own mind. They can't picture themselves celebrating the Eucharist, the liturgy, with the rest of the people that are there. This they can't conceive or understand. And maybe a lot of them don't want to understand because they still want to hold on to that old traditional way of thinking.
My grandfather was one who, when the change took place, he stopped going.
Yes, there was a lot of them.
Yeah, because he was 70-something, I think, in the... He really was, you know, he felt offended at the thing, because of lack of education process.
Yeah, really, that was it. I really think that in his school today, too. I still think it's today, too. How you can overcome that, I don't know. It's hard to educate people if they don't want to be educated. It's hard to, you can't cram things down people's throats, but until we find some way, I guess we're still going to have this misunderstanding.
On the history of St. Paul's, and, you know, summing up, you know, do you have anything that, in general, you would like to add about its history as a parish, as a community, etc. You know, how has it changed, or how has it remained the same?
Well, I think St. Paul's has become a more a part of the community of the Middletown, Springfield Township since Vatican II, because of some of the changes that allows the priests and the parishioners to function in conjunction with a lot of the other faiths around them.
Ecumenical.
Yeah, ecumenical. A lot of our people, I am not really into that, what you call a lot, very heavy, although I think it is needed. lot of people still don't believe in such a thing. They don't go along with the ecumenical, but they believe in, you celebrate your faith, I'll celebrate my faith. But it's not a matter of celebrating faith, it's a matter of understanding each other's right to celebrate their faith and to get along with one another and to coexist and serve in things that involve the community with all faiths, regardless of what faith you are. And to me, that's what ecumenical is about. And I think that's where St. Paul's has become involved greater in the area because of that. Myself. Oh, I don't know, bingo might have
to. That's true. That's one thing that, you know, brings the non-Catholic
right.
with the Catholic together. Mm-hmm. Even back then, you know, like when the people I've asked who were involved, with John Mark Tam was involved with the original bingo, and Rich Billock.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that, you know, you had 90 to 100 some people there usually, you know, no problem. And that, of course, the majority were parishioners, but
mm-hmm.
you still had a lot of people from
sure.
from the community. And
yes.
That was one way at least to get them together, to, you know, as a...
In fact, I would say today, at St. Paul's Bingo, the majority are non-parishioners.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if we would have the majority of parishioners coming today as came back then along with the others, we probably have twice as much as we get today, which is an average of between 70 and 85 people Tuesday night. So really the majority I see are outside of the parish that are down there on Tuesday nights. But also...
I wonder if that's because the non-Protestant or the non-Catholic doesn't... They enjoy gambling more than the Catholic or...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really know. I always thought that the
Catholics were gamblers.
Yes. Yeah.
You talk to.
Yeah, I really did. I always thought the Catholics were the gamblers. I do know my own nationality, the Irish. They're very
yes.
much for
yes.
that. They don't have any qualms about gambling or drinking or anything.
But I think that's what you mentioned to some of that.
But I think in the relation to the St. Paul's involvement in the community, how it's perceived in the community, I also think that even though a lot of people were against building the CCD Center, a lot of us call it a white elephant, which it could have been done different, I think, and that's the only reason why. Not that I don't think that it was needed or it's functional, but I think that it has created a means by bringing the outside community in involved with St. Paul because of allowing people to hold different things at the CCD Center. We have the Lions, I think, hold some meetings there. We have the, what do you call it, the, well, the Boy Scouts too, but the other...
Kiwanis?
No, I don't know the Kiwanis, but the other one I'm trying to think of. Hold
some meetings.
Yeah, it's... I think it's things like that, plus we have the daycare center there now.
Yes, I guess. The last two interviews I've heard the white elephant.
Yeah.
How would you like to have been different as opposed to make it as a home as opposed to a...
Well, I don't think it's the fact of how it's being used I think I was against the type of construction myself. And so were a number of other.
You mean flat roof and that
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, right, yeah. I think it was, in the long run, it's more costly to maintain something like that than if you would have built
it. It's
a little more expensive.
To put the trusses and pitch to the roof,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of places are going to today.
Mm-hmm.
To have original flat roof structures, they have come in and thrown, you know, a slight pitch on
yeah.
top of them.
No, I think that for what it was intended to be used for, sure, it was great. So I was all for it, but I just didn't like the style of construction.
Okay, well, I thank you, Jack.
You're welcome, assistance. And thank you, Jerry. I don't hope it gives you help you in some way.
Yeah. You know, you're really like the first person who...